And please help me to welcome Bob D. from Las Vegas.
I'm Bob Darrell, I'm an alcoholic. I have a sobriety date, that's October 31st, 1978. I have a sponsor who knows they're my sponsor, which that's important. If your sponsor's not sure they're your sponsor, they're probably not. I have a home group, and the members of that group that attend regularly know it's my home group because I attend regularly and I have jobs there, and I serve. And those elements, and also my actions and the steps and other two of the legacies have kept me in good stead. So, I was talking to my friend Billy on the way over here, and we were talking about AA, how you never get done here. You just don't. If you think, if the people who get to a place in recovery where they think, I got this, I've arrived somewhere, are usually in a lot of trouble. Because there's no end to this. I'm a scuba diver, and if there's anyone here that dives, you get to know some things about marine biology after a while. And one of the things that we learned is that there's a type of shark, a lot of types of sharks, that God's made them in such a way that they can't do like the other tropical fish do, who sleep, lay on the reef and sleep at night. They must continue to move forward or they die. And the reason that they die is that if they sit still, then the water stops flowing over their gills and they cannot oxygenate their bloodstream and they literally will suffocate on their own inaction. And they must move forward. So they sleep in the deep blue. They go out into the deep blue and they have involuntary tail motion that just keeps them slowly moving forward, and they sleep in forward motion because they can't stay still. And I think I am that type of person. I think I'm that type of alcoholic. And you can observe this in AA with a frequency that's kind of disheartening at times, where people will feel like they've arrived. They will, you know, I don't need to do any more work in the steps, and I don't need to help any, I've helped enough people, and I've done enough service, and all, you know, the craziest thing over here is somebody with 30 years who's going to blow their brains out 2 years later, say, I've done a lot of that, let the newer people do it, yeah. Right? As if they no longer have alcoholism, they have alcoholism, right? Ignoring of a basic aspect of alcoholism, that it's a chronic disease. It's not an acute illness. And what's the difference between a chronic disease and an acute disease? Well, acute diseases are serious. They can kill you. Like pneumonia, various things, and they get you to a hospital, load you up with the right amount of antibiotics, they'll knock that pneumonia out once and for all. You don't need pneumonia meetings, pneumonia steps. You don't need a pneumonia sponsor. You're over the pneumonia, right? It's the stabilization is the end of the problem. Whereas chronic diseases like chronic heart disease, diabetes, and alcoholism, the stabilization is but a beginning of a lifetime of tweaking it. Because why is that? Well, my very being is riddled with something that goes to the root of all my troubles, and that's this propensity for selfishness, self-centeredness, obsessive self-concern. You know, it's a great conversation. Two alcoholics, one guy's talking, and the other guy's talking, and the other guy says, I'm talking too much about me. But what do you think of me? I mean, you know, it's like, right, me. It's like an obsessive self-concern. I remember I had this Harley. It was a show bike. this is embarrassing to admit. And it was a beautiful bike, and I had all the leathers on, right? And I used to like to drive through the shopping district so I could see myself in the mirror, in the windows. Right. That's like true narcissism, right? That's, if you ever heard the story of Narcissus, that's what happened. He was so obsessed with himself that he was staring at himself in his reflection on a lake, at the side of a lake, and he fell in the water and drowned from his own obsessive self-involvement, right? And so I got this problem. I am like the back of a toilet tank. I can work the steps, and it's just like flushing that toilet. I just kind of empty out of me, sort of spiritual, want to help others. But you can bet that immediately, like the back of a toilet tank, I'll start filling up with me again. And it doesn't make me a bad guy. It makes me a guy with a chronic spiritual condition. And so I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time, years ago. It's 43 and a half years now, but when I was probably, I don't even know where this started, but it was north of 15 years, maybe even over 20. And I started noticing some things that I've been through by this time. I've been through the steps several times, but I ain't right. Now I act right. And I hide it well, but I'm not right. And I don't fit sometimes. Sometimes I get those feelings. I don't even want to go to a meeting. Other times I just feel like out of sorts, you know? And I found this part. It's in the, this book is both 12 Steps and 12 Traditions and the Big Book. The guy had it made for me. And there's a part in step four. And when I read it, I thought, that's me. And I'm sober a long time. And that's still me at times. And it was disheartening. And it says, it's from our twisted relations with family, friends, and society at large that many of us have suffered the most. We have been especially stupid and stubborn about them. The primary fact that I fail to recognize is my total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. My egomania digs two disastrous pitfalls. Either I insist upon dominating the people I know. It doesn't look like that to me. It's for their own good. You know what I mean? It's for the common good. I insist upon dominating the people I know, or I depend upon them far too much. Did you ever get angry at someone because they don't do something you need them to do? Yeah. Right? Depend upon them far too much. Autonomy is lost. Depend upon them far too much. If I lean too heavily on people, they will sooner or later fail me, for they are human too and cannot possibly meet my incessant demands. In this way, my insecurity grows and festers. On the other hand, when I habitually try to manipulate others to my own willful desires, they revolt and resist me heavily. Then I developed hurt feelings, a sense of persecution, and a desire to retaliate. As I redouble my efforts at control and continue to fail, my suffering becomes acute and constant. I have not once sought to be one in a family, to be a friend among friends, to be a worker among workers, to be a useful member of society. Always I tried to struggle to the top of the heap or to hide underneath it. This self-centered behavior blocked a partnership relation with any of those about us. Of true brotherhood, I had small comprehension. And one of the things that one of the first things I related to an AA, and I didn't put this together for a while, was when after relating to the drinking and the phenomenon, after I related all that, and then people started talking about something that I'd never heard anybody talk about out there. They talked about these feelings of not fitting once they got sober. Chuck Chamberlain used to talk about, he used to say that there was one problem that contained all problems, and that was conscious and unconscious separation. A feeling at times that it's all of you and then there's me. A feeling of separation. A feeling as if there's some invisible yet impenetrable barrier between me and life. And everybody else is on the other side of this transparent barrier having fun, and then there's me over here. And I don't know about you guys, but I drank unconsciously to remove the barrier. I drank for freedom. I drank for the ability to come out and play. I drank because abstinence was such a lonely business for me. That in the early days of drinking, now I'm not talking about the end when it's turned on you and it's become dark and awful and self-pitying, but in the early days of drinking, in the days when the obsession was formed, and it wasn't an obsession with alcohol, it's an obsession with the effect of being able to connect with people, the effect of walking into a party or a bar, and I'm so lonely, and I'm depressed, and I'm full of worry and anxiety, it's not good. And then five drinks in, I found my lifelong friends. You know? Right? Do you remember that feeling? Like, oh my God, it was so amazing. And it was experientially real. I remember times feeling so connected to people. Oh God. I remember saying this one time to a bunch of guys I was drinking with, I said, I love you, man. I'd die for you, bro. You know, just that's amazing against the backdrop of how I feel sober, which is lost and alone and separate and apart from. Wilson uses a great term in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, and boy, does it fit me. He talks about a state of anxious apartness. I get that. And so I'm going through the steps, and I'm taking people through the steps, and I'm sponsoring a whole bunch of people, and I got a whole bunch of service commitments. And I'm really strong in two legacies. I'm strong in recovery because I'm doing big book workshops. I'm taking guys through the book. I'm strong. I'm good with that. And I start to, you know, because when you focus on the 12 steps in the big book for many years here, and then you're not right, you turn back to what you know. But maybe it's not what I know that will help me. Maybe it's what I don't know. I was good with service. I mean, I tell you, there were times in my sobriety where I don't think anybody could do more service. I had a couple H&I meetings every week, panels. I was on conference committees. I was on the 12-step. I mean, I was GSR, DC. I mean, I was doing all of that. So I was strong at two legacies, the legacy of recovery and the legacy of service. But if you would have asked me, well, how are you practicing unity? What are the principles you're trying to live by? I wouldn't have known what to say. I'd say, well, I got a home group. And I do service, but that's service. What about unity? And a guy in AA had said, I'd heard him say this. He talked about practicing the 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous as if they were a set of principles to personally live by. Not some obscure rules for some AA group or What if you looked at them as a set of principles that would change your life? And I'll tell you what I've discovered over the years. I think of everything in Alcoholics Anonymous for personal growth, for connectedness, to give us everything we yearned for when we got here. The 12 traditions are actually the higher set of spiritual principles. Isn't that odd? And how we ignore them. You know, I remember early sobriety, when I say early, I mean my first 5 years maybe. I'd go to a 12 steps and 12 traditions meeting, and if I walked in the room and I discovered that they were on a tradition, I snuck out. It's like that scene from that movie, The Treasure of Sierra Madre. I don't need no stinking traditions, you know, right? I don't like that stuff. I labeled it. That's the political end of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? Those are the rules. I don't need rules. I serve. But I serve separately. I serve in a state of separation. And so I started thinking about these things and how asking myself questions that I don't think many of us ask. What would I do different if these were the guiding principles of my life? How would I show up in my relationships? I'll tell you, the 12 traditions, our marriage is based on those. My business that I ran very successfully for decades, I ran them on the 12 traditions. And I had employees that they weren't in AA, but they understood. When you said to them, listen, the common welfare has to come first. They all go, oh yeah. You say that to alcoholics and they go, yeah, but what about me? What about me? What about me? Right? They understood group conscience. They understood a lot of these things because these are spiritual principles that just seem to be in the human heart. So I'm gonna start sharing my experience on some of these things, and maybe it's useful. I hope it is. So in the first tradition, now I'm gonna talk quite a bit about the long form. How many people in here are real familiar with the long form of the traditions?
Right.
Right. See, that is universal. And in AA, around the country, there's a lot of people that have never even looked at the long form. And yet, historically, the long form was written by Bill Wilson. And it was his view on how to overcome feelings of separation in Alcoholics Anonymous. He wrote them at a time when AA was just fragmenting and just falling apart, very much like what had happened to the Washingtonians. And he wrote them in the long form and then spent a couple years trying to get the groups to adopt them. And oh my God, they wouldn't do it. There's letters in our archives asking Bill, the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, to come and speak at their group anniversary, provided you don't mention those traditions, right? And he spent 2 years frustrated, couldn't even get groups to read them. And I get it. If you've ever been in a meeting where they read the long form, they're freaking long. I mean, you know, they used to read in my old home group, and you just watch the newcomers. Eyes glaze over like as they go on, and just with that look on their face like, make it stop. Let's get back to the important stuff that has to do with me, you know. So out of frustration, after being unable to get groups to even read them, there was a guy that Dr. Bob, his story's in the back of the book, Earl Treat from Chicago. And Earl wrote an abbreviated version. And he presented it, and Bill was a little hate. He said, this isn't quite what we're trying to do. But eventually, he gave in and co-signed the 12 traditions, which is in the short form, which were presented in the conference in 1950, were adopted. And the sad part is there's a huge difference between the principles outlined in the long form and the short form. And I think we've hurt ourselves. So I encourage the guys I sponsor, go back and read what Wilson wrote. Read the original intention for unity and connectedness and the principles as he set them down. So in the short form, defines the problem. Just like in step tradition one, the problem is defined. Step one, the problem is defined. And you go through this process. And by the time you get to step 12, the answer is in place. It's a composite of everything in all those steps. Because in step 12, the answer is in place. It says, having had a spiritual awakening as the single result of these steps. So you go through the steps, and by the time you get to step 12, and this is true universally. I watch guys. You can go through the first 11 steps, and you don't get to 12. It's just another selfish, self-seeking endeavor. But once a guy has got through the first 11 steps, and he's acting on the 12th step, and he's starting to sponsor people, it's a game changer. It's a game changer. I always sponsor a lot of guys, and I get these new guys, and they're crazy. They're supposed to be. They're crazy. They're so full of themselves and their own fears, and the sky's falling. And oh my God, some of these new guys, when they call you, it's like, all right, buckle in. 20 minutes about what she's doing wrong. You know, that buckle in, right? And once you get them to start sponsoring people, everything shifts. And now they're starting to laugh at the silliness of their sponsees. And I got to remind them, well, that's just like what you did, isn't it? You know, they start to see a different perception. Now the conversations are not about, they're not narcissistic, all about them and their problems and their worries and their resentments. They start being about other people. Their concerns, their obsessive self-involvement has shifted to almost an obsessive concern and love for the people they're trying to help. It's a game changer. I can't imagine sponsoring 10 people who refuse to help anybody. Oh my God, you'd want to hang yourself. I mean, just all the level of narcissism would wear you out. But once they start helping others, once they start doing service, once they get a job in their home group, it changes them. It changes them. Because what is the problem? The book says that the root of all of it is selfishness and self-centeredness, and altruistic, other-centered actions that are often inconvenient will pull you up off of you in a way that you can meditate for 4 hours and not get that kind of freedom. Right? So, it says, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. My personal recovery, my life, depends upon staying connected here. And I stay connected here because I have a sponsor on one side and I have sponsees on the other. I remember going 35 years ago, I was up in the Rocky Mountains at some event, and I had a day, and we went up and looked at this lake. This lake was amazing. Their water was so pristine and so pure and clear. You could see the stones on the bottom of the lake. It was beautiful. And I realized why that's so. Because on one side of the lake, you have a stream that's rapidly throwing water into the lake. And on the other side of the lake, you have a stream with water flowing out. And consequently, it cannot stagnate. And I think, I'm like that. I gotta be tethered to a sponsor who I'm turning towards in a surrendered manner to get direction and not relying totally on my own head. And then I got people that turn to me, and I turn to them sometimes, that I run with, that I sponsor, that lift me up off my own heart. That as I try to help them and I'm concerned with them. And that is what connects me here, to be between those two forces of the willingness and the surrender to allow direction and thoughts and things to come in from the people that are sober longer than me and my sponsor, and then also the willingness to inconvenience myself. And I'll tell you, by helping others, the more inconvenient an action is in AA, the higher the spiritual coinage. I'm telling you, if your whole life here is just about convenience, you're missing it. You're missing it. So my personal recovery depends upon me being connected here, being one with you. I drank for unity. I do AA for unity. And if you're sober a number of years and you're not connected and a part of here, you've missed some stuff. Trust me. And so that's the goal. Just like lack of power and unmanageability was the problem, lack of unity is the problem in the traditions. And so you go up against the second tradition, which is remarkable. I mean, first of all, in the short form, it's longer than in the long form, which is bizarre and makes the traditions kind of alcoholic by nature. But in the add-on, in the short form, Wilson says something, actually, her Treat said something that really makes AA different than any organization on the planet. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. AA is the only organization on the planet where you come in a big shot and work your way up to servant. You work your way into a more humble state. You don't work your way into big shotism. As a lot of places, most of you go to work somewhere, you start sweeping the floors. Hopefully one day you're the manager. In Alcoholics Anonymous, maybe hopefully one day you serve. One day you're willing to push yourself aside and inconvenience yourself for the benefit of others and the benefit of AA. And so our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not cover it. And this concept of God, our ultimate authority, that it expresses itself through this consciousness in a group. I don't know about you guys, but I had hundreds of experiences in my first 10 or 20 years. I still have some of them today. I just was in a noon meeting not too long ago where I heard something. Tell you, it was perfect. Where God will talk to you. He'll talk to you in an AA meeting. I've had, how many times do guys like myself and people I suppose like some of you will walk into a meeting and you just got some kind of big setback financially, maybe in your relationship, or something bad's happened to you. Or maybe you just got some stuff spinning in your head. You know, because we're good at solving problems that haven't occurred yet. I mean, we're just good at that. And maybe you're just full of those and they're just on you and they're depressing your very being and they're causing a level of anxiety that may, I don't know about you, but I've had anxiety to the point where I feel like I'm going to have a nervous breakdown. And I keep it all quiet because I want to look like I'm spiritually fit, right? So I can't even tell my sponsor because I don't want to look bad. And you go to a meeting and some stranger in the meeting will start talking about exactly the way you feel. Who's the choreographer? Who got that guy to say what he said when he said what he said? And who made that and fit that exactly to what's going on with you? Isn't that odd? And so I really, truly do believe that God shows up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think there's a covenant here that when two or more of us come together for the purpose of recovery, not to talk about our problems, but for the purpose of recovery, that there's something in the midst that is greater than the sum of the parts. And in a strong AA meeting, like if you were to come to my home group on a Tuesday night, a Friday night, or a Monday night and you walk into the room, you'll feel it. There's something there. There's something there. And it's something that's gonna, it's gonna express itself through this consciousness. Carl Jung, who was really involved in the early days of AA, he called it the collective unconscious, that something works through people. In the book, it says that deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. In the last analysis, that's where it is, the great reality deep down within us. And something happens to guys like us, people like us, when we get with each other with a desire to help and a desire for recovery, is that that portal opens up. And those of you that sponsor people, I'm sure you've had that experience where you're sitting with someone you sponsor and they're not doing very well, and you care about them, and you'd like to help them, but you don't. You go inside yourself to try to say something that would help them, and you got nothing. And then, out of your desire, which is a word that comes from the old English of the father, sire, as your desire to help them, it's like this portal opens up. And I've had this experience many times, and I'll just find myself saying things I don't know where it comes from, but it's right. It's right. It's exactly what I was supposed to say. And it is not of me. It is through me. It's the ultimate authority here expressing himself, because it's me and a guy that we're sitting here in this coffee shop for the purpose of recovery, right? And God talks through us, if you let him. He won't while you're on the phone, while you're texting, while you're on Facebook. There's no God. There's no God in Facebook. It's a lot of me. So to stay present, and because of that, and knowing that's like that, I developed a reverence for Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why I don't, in a meeting, I'm not on my phone. In a meeting, I try, unless I have to, there's certain things that are unavoidable, like if you have to get up and go to the bathroom, but I don't get up and walk around. I don't talk to people during the meeting. I don't want to do anything that might make this guy sitting right here, who's not gonna make it if he doesn't hear something, I don't wanna get in the way of him hearing what he needs to hear. And I don't know what he needs to hear, but I know he'll hear it. There was a friend of mine in Texas, Jimmy, he told his sponsor, he was newly sober, and he was getting lit up by AA. Things were happening. He was hearing what he was needing to hear, but he just got rebellious one night. He said, I'm not going. I'm not going to go to the group. I'm not going. I'm staying home. He called his sponsor the next day. He said, you didn't go. He said, nope, I didn't. I stayed home, watched TV, had a good night. He said, well, you missed it. And the guy goes, missed it. Missed what? He said, I don't know. I only heard what I was supposed to hear. We'll never know what you were supposed to hear. And he said, oh, my God, I got to go every day. Well, right. God will talk to you here. Pay attention. Pay attention in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't get in the way of someone else here. Even if you don't want to hear, if you don't want to be there, if you'd rather be on your phone, don't do anything that's going to distract the guy sitting next to you. Don't be that selfish. Allow the person and the people sitting around you to have their experience. And so I have a reverence for how God works through Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's funny, isn't that odd? Because I came here, I was an atheist. But you stay involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and eventually you realize, man, there's something here. I didn't get this at the bars. There's something here. And you start eventually, if you're like me, eventually, you know, I started out with, it was the Force from Star Wars, and eventually it was, I guess it's God. Even though it's another thing that I was wrong about, because I didn't think there was a God. And eventually something rises to the surface and you see it, and it's evidently it is God, or it's something. But a rose by any other name is still just as sweet and just as fragrant. It's God. Our third tradition is, I want to spend a little time talking about this, and also this is where we lost a lot of ground in Alcoholics Anonymous. When Wilson conceded to the short form and went from the membership requirement as defined in his original intention in the long form to the short form, AA changed AA, and I'm not so sure it changed it for the better. Now, some people might argue that it did because it opened it up to all kinds of people. But the original, and I'll read this, the original membership requirement in the third tradition, it says our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. I'm an everyday member of AA because I suffer from alcoholism. I'm sober 43 and a half years. If I stop doing AA, I start to suffer from alcoholism. That's why it's the foundation of my membership, is I'm under the gun of alcoholism. You can't go to enough meetings to be over your alcoholism. You know, that's one of the delusions it talks about in our book in chapter 3. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. The idea that if I do I'll just do a whole bunch of AA. About 5-10 years, a whole bunch. Now just, I'm good now. I'm good, thanks. Good. Or that your recovery is based and judged on how you feel. That is a terrible narcissistic view of your own recovery. I knew a guy, this is probably 20 years ago maybe, I don't know, maybe more. I was at this detox in Vegas doing a panel, brought a meeting in there. There was a guy in there who wanted to share, and he'd been sober 17 years and drank again. And in his sharing, he expressed how baffled he was that he drank again because there were no problems in his life. He had 2 paid-for cars in the garage, a beautiful, beautiful house, 3 kids that adored him, and a wife that loved him. Great job making deep 6 figures a year. Not a cloud, as it says in that story in the book, where he says there was not a cloud on the horizon, right? And he drank. He drank not at a low point in his life, but he drank at a high point. Not a cloud on the horizon. And he said all of this, and it was, when you think about it, you think, well, yeah. No. What he's saying is that the cars, the house, the kids, the comfort and how he felt was a treatment for alcoholism. What if you went to a hospital and a doctor allowed you to go in and talk to a guy who just came out of a diabetic coma, and he said to you, I don't know why I went into a diabetic coma. I have a new car. You'd want to smack him, wouldn't you? Just like, what are you, crazy? What's that have to... Good thing applied to the wrong problem, right? I think we're the kind of people that we read somewhere, jogging's good for you. So we break our ankle and we think, well, I'll jog. Good answer, wrong problem. And alcoholism is much like that. It demands treatment. Demands treatment. So I'm an everyday member. And the book goes on to say our membership includes all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, that's a word you don't hear in the bars. Hence. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover. Recover from what? From alcoholism. And there's a huge difference between having a desire not to drink and suffering from alcoholism. Huge difference. In page 20 and 21, it talks about 3 different types of drinkers. First type talks about is very seldom ever even get to AA. But you might have family members like that. They can take it or leave it alone. My sister's like that. My daughter's like that. They're not sure. If you offer them a drink, they're not sure if they want a Coke or a beer. It doesn't matter, really. They just want something wet and cold. But what about people like me? I stop drinking and I get weird. This is also baffling. The way alcoholism uses your own mind against you. When I get weird, I don't think I'm weird, but my God, you are. You know what I mean? It just so becomes so clear. All of a sudden, I'm working with stupid people, you know? All of a sudden, the people share, oh, don't call on him again. Oh, no, not Mr. Phony Gratitude for Everything guy. Don't call on him. Oh, don't call on her. Oh, my God, you can hear the angel wings flapping in the background when she shares. Don't decide that. And what happens is that I don't know it, but I'm back in the bondage of self. And I don't know it. And that's how alcoholism takes guys like me out. I don't get it. I don't get it. I always have a couple guys in my life that are suffering from alcoholism, but they don't know it. And you can't tell them, because when you're in the grip of the bondage of self, you're defended. You're entitled. And you're idea resistant. If you ever try to talk to someone who's suffering from alcoholism, maybe a week before they drink again. It's hard to talk to them. By the time a guy like me is down, and I've been on this road. It's a horrible road when you have to explain and defend and justify and rationalize yourself, where other people try to say, hey, Bob, you're off base here. No, I'm not, and I'll explain it to you. You know, the defensiveness, the ego bristles with antagonism when it's thwarted or confronted. I loved what, there was a great psychiatrist who worked with Bill Wilson back in the 50s. And he was actually on our board, General Service Board. He was as a trustee, spoke at one of our internationals. Dr. Harry Tebow. And Harry Tebow said a lot of things that, and Chuck Chamberlain said versions of the same thing. He said that the alcoholic must have ego reduction at depth. We're looking for to be relieved of the bondage of self. Very similar, if not the same. That somehow I got to get smaller here. When everything in me screams that I need to be bigger, I need to get smaller here. Because the smaller I get, the closer you are. The smaller I get, the bigger God is. He talked about the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. Oh my God, it's unbelievable. You ever work with a newcomer who comes up to you and they say things like, I've ruined my life. I can't even trust my own thinking. I just, would you help me? I'll do anything you want me to do. And 3 weeks later, they're going, you want me to what? Yeah. Right? The resurgence of the alcoholic ego. We get full of ourselves. Isn't it? I think some of us die from alcoholism right before we die, we're the smartest one in the room. We're the smartest one in the room. So in this separation, somehow I gotta get with you. I gotta get back to the first tradition, that my personal recovery depends upon unity here. I gotta be connected to you. If you're new and you're like me at all, you probably have been looking around Alcoholics Anonymous and noticing what's wrong with all the people there. And there's a lot. There's a lot wrong with us. And yet, can you push that aside? Can you push your own perception and judgment and come here and be helpful and be of service. And I'll tell you what I've discovered. It's really been very true for me that anything you serve, you'll eventually fall in love with. Even if it's people, even if it's someone, you're trying to be helpful to someone you don't like because they're not doing it right. You continue to be helpful to that person and your perception of them will shift. And anything you continue to serve, you'll continue to stay in love with. That's why all three of these legacies are interlaced and they work together. For me to become a part of here, I have to serve. For me to become a part of, I have to clear out all the crap in me that I do through the steps 4 through 9 that gets between me and you. It's really self. In this sickness of separation, here's my experience. When I'm separate from you or I'm separate from God and I'm just going through the motions of prayer, but I feel no conscious contact and no connection, you can bet that I got too much of me between me and you. And I got too, with my opinions and my judgments and my wants and my desire, I got too much of me between me and you, and I got too much of me between me and God. And so as Harry Thiebaud said, we must have ego reduction at depth. We do all this stuff so I can get smaller, so that I can serve, so that I can be free here. You know, there's an old adage in AA I don't think is true. You hear it all the time. Let us love you until you can love yourself. Stop it. Oh, Jesus. You can't, that doesn't work. I mean, if being loved would save me, my parents would have saved me. I have girlfriends that would have saved me. You can't love me enough. I'm the black hole of love. You can sacrifice, as my parents did, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on therapists and treatment centers. They couldn't have loved me anymore. Just kept forgiving me, kept taking me back, kept helping me. Never helped me. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys say, you buy me a sandwich once in a while to luncheon meeting, but you really don't help me along the lines that I think you should. And what you do is, my first sponsor was beautiful at this. He would just needle me. He would just make fun of me. He would he was just relentless. And my second sponsor was the same way. Clancy was unbelievable. Oh my God. He'd find humor in your problems where you didn't think it existed. I mean, oh my God. And what happens? What becomes real? Let us laugh at you until you can finally laugh at yourself. Because when you can laugh at yourself, you're free. When you laugh at yourself, the narcissism is kind of gone. You've lifted you up off of you. One of the major symptoms of the bondage of self, of ego, is seriousness. When you're scared and you're watching everything, trying to control it, there's no joy. There's no laughter. You're not free. In Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the greatest gifts it's given me through sponsorship is you got me eventually to start laughing at myself. And that's such a beautiful thing. Because if you can laugh at yourself, you will always be entertained. I mean, the things you think. I mean, we don't like to talk about that stuff because some of it makes you look bad. But I think some bizarre stuff. Like, I was just at a meeting and some guy was one of those guys that when he shares, you can hear the angel wings flapping in the background. He was talking about how spiritual he was. I just remember thinking to myself, what if I just walk up to him after the meeting and plant the heel of my foot in the middle of his foot? Would he still be spiritual? Now, I don't do that, and I don't say that, but I think it. I think, and I see it, and then I laugh. I laugh at myself and the crazy thoughts that I have. You know why I laugh at it? Because I know the truth. It's not me. But I am my favorite comic and my favorite audience. I find stuff funny nobody else finds funny. Especially serious people. They don't think anything's funny. If you've ever watched the newcomers come to the meeting and they're just like and you'll hear stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous that's hilarious. Not to them. Some guy talks about, yeah, I came to and I didn't know where I was and I peed on the Christmas tree and then fell into it and passed out. People will roar. They'll think, oh my God, that's amazing. Not the new people. Right? Because that's what self does. Self serious is a guy like me up. I know, man, I was serious. My sponsor was messing with me all the time because I was so serious. But he got me to lighten up eventually. And I'm so grateful for that. Because sometimes in my home group or in any conferences, wherever, you'll hear people laugh. And it's contagious and it spreads through the room. And if you listen real closely on an emotional and not an intellectual level, it's almost like you're hearing the voice of God telling all of us, it's okay. We got you. It's okay. And you'll hear that in the laughter. And I think that's very important. Tradition 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. This principle, this freedom from autonomy is not without responsibility. And so we hope, I guess, and I hope this is true for me, that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me the freedom to do pretty much anything I want to do. But I hope I'm awake to the price. I hope I'm awake to its potential effect on the people around me, on other AA groups, on the people I sponsor. One of the great things that's happened to me in AA is I woke up to the most beautiful awakening that I sponsor all these guys and I am the first example they look to on what's okay to do sober. When you start getting that, and you're doing some stuff that's a little dodgy, you'll want to change your act. Not for me, but I don't want to be. His sponsees will follow. They won't follow your good traits. Oh no, it's like a kid, like a little kid. You can say words at home like love, kindness, and forgiveness. You can say all those words. The kids ignore it. Use the F word once. That kid will grab that out of the air and he'll take it everywhere he goes and uses it. And I think newcomers are like that. Sponsees are like that. They'll just watch for the one thing. It's why I just had a conversation with a guy recently. I don't know if he heard me or not. You got to stop playing around with the new girls. Because you're sober a long time and you sponsor a lot of people. And you got sponsees that are doing what you do. You can do anything you want, but for God's sakes, don't be a bad example here. Because it undermines the first tradition, the common welfare. You can't put, there's an equation in tradition 1. It's God first, you second, me last. You can't reverse that. You can't be me first, me first, me first, with no consideration of others and no consideration of God. You can't do it. You won't stay here. I know. I've watched guys that have been predators in Alcoholics Anonymous, either financial predators, sexual predators, or prestige predators. And they eventually move themselves out of AA. Because you can't escape the reality. And the reality is, if I'm doing something that's selfish and hurting someone else, I will eventually, I can sweep it under the rug, but I will eventually feel about myself the way I would feel about someone else that was doing those things in my home group. How can you escape that? And so we go out of here, we don't like ourselves much. By the time we selfishly move ourselves out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's one of the great things about good sponsorship. A good sponsor wants more for you than you do. He wants you to be the best version of you. He wants you to be the vital, effective, and useful version of you. Where me? Not so much. I want to be the gratified, fun version of me. But my friend Ralph says something, it's really true. He says, how often trouble starts out looking like fun. Our book says that we pause when agitated, and then it describes that as excitement, worry, resentment, you know, all those things. One of the things that was hard for me to understand, excitement is a type of agitation, but it feels good. It's a good feeling agitation. Oh yeah. As you know what that's like when you're in the process of getting your way or getting some instant gratification or getting whatever, fill in the blank. It's exciting. And how often, as Ralph says, that trouble starts out looking like fun. Tradition number five, and then we'll take a little break. This has become very important to me because my falling away from it almost destroyed me when I was 19 years sober. And I don't think guys like me who go to a lot of meetings and sponsor people and have a sponsor, I don't think we drift quickly off track. I think it's like a glacier, just a slow, incremental shift. And in the fifth tradition, it talks about my primary purpose. It says, and it's each group or member, and I got to put this on me, has a primary number one purpose above everything, above yourself. And that primary purpose is to help the other alcoholics, to help alcoholics who still suffer. A good question to ask myself on a regular basis, is that my primary purpose or am I my primary purpose? And I incrementally shifted. I was the guy in my first 12 years or maybe 50, I don't know, for quite some time where, man, I was doing it. I lived to help drunks. I mean, that was my primary, number one above everything, purpose. Starting meetings, treatment center, just I was on fire, filling my cars full with new guys. And then what happened? Thing that happens to all of us, it says it's easy. In step 10, it's easy to let up on this spiritual program of action and rest on your laurels. I'm telling you, it's easy. Guys like me get seduced by the fruits of my own recovery into a false sense of okayness now, and I'm all right, and I could do my own thing, kind of. And I just slipped over a period of several years away from making you and helping you as my number one purpose in life to helping me. And in my 19th year sober, I'll tell you, that year, it accumulated and the wheels fell off. And Chuck Chamberlain used to say that you will eventually can get to a place where you will run out of things to put between you and you. And there you are. And I got to that place, I was 19 years sober, and I made more money that year than I'll ever make. Truly. I had three very expensive cars, two Harleys, one was in a magazine, big house up on the hill looking over the city of Las Vegas, a lot of money in the bank, and I sunk into a dangerous, potentially fatal depression, which was baffling to me because I had everything I wanted. This sounds bizarre. But you can get to a place where you can run out of things to buy. I mean, it's like, I got everything. Got everything. And I was going to die. I was going to die. As a friend of mine in a $15 million house took a pistol and put it to his head with 15 years sober and blew his brains out. As a guy who was one of the most famous people on the planet who'd been in so many movies and he had TV shows, he was one of the most talented men I've ever known, probably worth somewhere north of $300 million. And he relapsed after a lot of years of sobriety, and then he couldn't get back and he killed himself. Right? Because no matter how good you get it out here, truly, if it's not good in here, it ain't no good. That's why the shine, you can have a life full of abundance and the shine is worn off on all of it. And then it's just you. It's just you. And that's where I was at 19 years sober, and it was scary. It was, and I didn't understand it. It made no sense to me. I thought, my God, if I were in this kind of slump, this kind of abyss, there were other times in my sobriety where I should have felt like this. When I was going through my divorce, I should have felt like this. Actually, I did pretty well through that. Why am I now when everything is good? No, not a cloud on the horizon. But I'd filled up with me. And my primary purpose stopped being seeking God and helping his kids, and it started being me. 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 And I was dying. I didn't know it. And I went to a meeting. I was so depressed I could almost not get there, but I got there. And an old friend of mine who was sober actually a year and a half more than I was telling him about how horrible I feel. And I swear, God, this guy's not that bright. God spoke through him. And he said to me, I'll never forget, he said, well, he said, you still go to meetings. You sponsor some people, I suppose, and you run your mouth a lot in AA. He said, but I don't think your primary purpose is helping others anymore. I think your primary purpose is you. And that pierced me. And it hurt. And it hurt because it was true. Because it was true. And it snapped me. I was scared. I was scared. It snapped me. And I tell you, before the week was out, I had my car full of new guys again. I'm turning the volume up on my actions in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm reclaiming my primary, number one, above everything, purpose. And I'd lost my way. A lot of us do. It doesn't make us bad people. It's the fruits of sobriety are seductive. Seductive. But alcoholism is a chronic illness. And alcoholism doesn't care how nice your house is. It doesn't care about your kids. It doesn't care about any of that stuff. Alcoholism is a sickness that demands treatment. And in this altruistic program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the treatment lies primarily in forgetting ourselves and helping others. Now that doesn't sound like good news to selfish people. And yet it's the freeing mechanism from the bondage of self. You know, I was diagnosed clinically depressed by two different psychiatrists in the 70s, and I stand here, and I haven't been depressed except for that one little time, 19 years. I haven't been depressed. I haven't suffered from depression. I've taken no therapy or treatment or medication for depression except Alcoholics Anonymous. And I take a lot of AA. I do a lot of AA. Depression can't hit a moving target. And are you willing to do the self-sacrifice? Wilson says in his story that unless the alcoholic can perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through two things, and it's not prayer and meditation. You'd think it would be. It's not.
He says, through self-sacrifice, constant thought of others, their needs, and how we can work for them. That is how I perfect and enlarge my spiritual life, through altruism. And I don't think you don't have to read a lot of books or explore a lot of different things, whether it's Mother Teresa, the Dalai Lama, some of the great writers in Catholicism, Judaism, Rami, and they all say that, don't they? Don't they all say that? Forget yourself, help others. Forget yourself, help others. Trust God, clean house, help others. That's what Dr. Bob wrote on one of his prescription pads and gave it to a guy. He said, well, here's the prescription for sobriety, and he gave that to him. Trust God, which really implies that you're not going to trust yourself anymore. Trust God, clean house, go make the amends, go face the stuff, get small enough to be humble, to do all that stuff, and then devote your life to helping others. Big things happen, just to the extent that we can, that I can do that. I don't always, I drift. I leak sometimes. We all do. I love what Wilson said. He said, sometimes we're bound not by the things we do right. We're bound by our defects. You know, we're bound by, nothing better than going to a meeting and I really screwed up about something and I share it and five people goes, oh, that's nothing. You should see what I did. It's like, wow. Let's take a 10 minute break. Okay, 10 minute break.